What do they need most in Kathmandu right now? Fresh water is the thing. A Nepalese aid and economic summary on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 27th of April. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. The death toll in Nepal after this weekend's earthquake is closing in on 4,000 now. People are, as you've heard, sleeping outside. They are so scared of aftershocks. Supplies are getting tight, but aid is on the way. I talked with the BBC's Sanjoy Majumdar in Kathmandu a couple of hours ago, where it was, at the time we were speaking, the middle of the night.
Well, yes, exactly. It's very dark because, in fact, it's not just the city of Kathmandu, but the entire Kathmandu Valley, which has been without power for some time now, ever since the earthquake struck. Generators are powering up a lot of the supplies. But really, the concern is not so much shortages of fuel, although that is something that people are worried about. It's actually shortage of drinking water. That's a huge issue because the normal supplies have dried up and the government is quite concerned that if that isn't addressed quickly, it could lead to a situation where you might have disease spreading among people who are already spending their nights out in the open. And that would, of course, present a whole new problem for the authorities and for the aid agencies that are coming in.
About those aid agencies, are you seeing any signs of that arriving yet?
Oh, you're seeing plenty of signs of them arriving. In fact, the airport's completely chock-a-block with flights trying to land, not just aid flights, but a lot of commercial flights have added extra flights to bring in supplies and also take people out. On the ground as well, you can see aid agencies at work. There are people from every or a number of countries, not just the neighboring countries, India, which was first off the block to send men, material and other supplies. But also China, Sri Lanka, and then further afield, the Americans, of course, have sent in a lot of supplies and money. So there are a lot of agencies on the ground. You can see them and identify them. But the scale of the problem is quite big. So, of course, it's never going to be enough, certainly not now.
Right. What is the government's perceived ability to deal with all the aid that they're about to get? Because the government there has been divided and not especially well-functioning for the past number of years.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, there has been a lot of political turmoil in Nepal in the past few years, past decade, actually. And that's one of the many reasons that they haven't really been able to set up systems that could have dealt with a tragedy of this size slightly more systematically. I think it was too much to expect them to be prepared for something of this scale. But just having a disaster management plan in place, having a building code in place where you can perhaps prepare earthquake-proof housing in areas which are more vulnerable. And that's the reason why the government was very quick to readily accept the fact that this was too much for them to handle on their own and therefore invite the international community to get involved.
Quickly, Sanjoy, before I let you go, what are you doing? Are you sleeping in a tent outside someplace or are you inside in a building?
We are inside a hotel, but no one's actually sleeping in their rooms, which are higher up, simply because we've had a number of aftershocks over the past couple of days, which are quite frightening, actually. Everything starts shaking, so you want to be somewhere closer to an exit. So we're all sleeping, some by the pool, some in the hotel lobby, just any place you can find from where you can get up and get out if you have to.
The BBC's South Asia correspondent, Sanjoy Majumdar, we got him in Kathmandu, Nepal. Sanjoy, thank you, and take care of yourself.
Thanks. Good night.
The rebuilding process in Nepal, after all of the recovery is eventually done, is going to take years. But there's a particular quirk of the Nepalese economy that might make that process harder and longer. There are millions of Nepalese, mostly young, able-bodied men, who've left. They've gone overseas to find work that wasn't there for them at home. Then they take part, or most probably, of their paychecks and send it home in what's called remittances. Marketplace's Noel King explains Nepal's dependence on that cash.
Every day, around 1,000 Nepalese board airplanes to Saudi Arabia, Malaysia, Qatar, or they go overland to India. They're looking for work. They usually find it in construction and the service sector. The unemployment rate in Nepal is roughly 40%. Tim Gosher is chairman of the Dolma Development Fund, a nonprofit that provides healthcare and education. He is spending another nervous night under the stars in Kathmandu. He says the effects of migration are unmissable.
It's particularly common in the rural districts where you see see a lot less young men. It is mostly men. You also see it advertised seemingly on every other shopfront. Get visas to work abroad, to study abroad, etc.
Many of those who work abroad send money to their families. The World Bank says nearly 30% of Nepal's GDP, about $6 billion, comes in the form of remittances. Dilip Rada is manager of the Migration and Remittances Unit at the World Bank.
At the very poor level, it is really a lifeline that provides people with food, with shelter, with education and, you know, money for business investments and health as well.
Remittances are crucial. Sanjeev Sirchan is executive director of the Asia Society's Global Initiatives Group. He says there's a possible downside. Sirchan says even before the quake, there was a shortage of construction workers in Kathmandu.
So definitely, as the country rebuilds or struggles to rebuild, we are going to have severe problem with reconstruction of the country. There will be a severe shortage of labor, definitely.
On the other hand, the World Bank's Dilip Rada points out that the money being sent home will be all that much more important now. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a long, slow slide into negative territory at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are days when your interview schedule lines up neatly with what is going on in the world, and today is one of those days. David Miliband is the president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee. It's a global humanitarian assistance group. David, thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here.
Have to start with Nepal, I think, given the events of the weekend. Are you guys in Nepal yet, as far as you know?
We're not in Nepal because it's not been a country that's been consumed by conflict. Mm. And the International Rescue Committee, our calling card, is crisis and conflict. Fortunately, there are quite a lot of NGOs, some of them environmental, some of them anti-poverty NGOs that are on the ground. And obviously, the international system is mobilizing. But with 2,500 people dead and obviously fears of more, it's really touched people's hearts.
There is plenty of conflict that you are involved with. I want to focus on two, actually, for the balance of our talk. The first is what's going on in the Mediterranean with the Libyans and the sub-Saharan Africans trying to get over to Europe. It does seem that the European Union has been dragged kicking and screaming into some kind of rescue operation. Do you disagree with that?
I think that you're right to say that European attention has been dragged back. We're in Mali. We're in Chad. There are people from there ending up in North Africa trying to get to Europe, never mind the situation in Libya itself. And so it's incredibly challenging. Europeans are not standing together. Italians and Greeks are being expected to handle this on their own, more or less, rather than as a united European response. And obviously that's, as someone who for the last 18 months has been living in New York but is a European, that's something I lament.
When you get senior-level people over there on the phone, which I'm sure you do with some regularity, what do they say when you say, come on, get it together?
They say two or three things. First of all, that the end of the Mare Nostrum program, which was running last year, is something
the,
that they
the rescue program.
Yeah, that they deeply regret. Secondly, they say that it's very, very tough to do the obvious thing, which is to try to tackle this at source. You can't just deal with this problem in southern Europe. Thirdly, the truth is about the European Union at the moment is that its bandwidth is really stretched. I mean, it's dealing with the euro crisis still. It's got the Ukraine confrontation with Russia. And I get the feeling that for European leaders, they haven't been able to focus on something that is important but not hasn't until now been seen as urgent and has therefore not been on the front burner.
Also, Syria. A horrible, obviously, situation over there. What are you doing? What is your group doing there? And can it possibly do enough good?
So the International Rescue Committee has about 2,500 staff in Syria and in the four neighboring countries. We're focusing on health, education, also some protection for women and girls. We're managing about $200 million worth of grants. But there's a really big message for people listening to this program. We don't just need to do more in the Syria crisis. But we've got to do things differently as well. And I just want to give you one example of what it means to do things differently. The refugees from Syria are educated people. They're tech-savvy people. until now, there's been no proper tech platform for them to find out what services are available to them. And I'm very, very pleased that a partnership of the International Rescue Committee and the US government is creating for the first time a kind of Yelp for refugees in Lebanon.
I chuckle, but it's serious because you got to find out what they need and what they want.
It's serious. It's not just for them to find out where services are available, services for where they can cash in vouchers, services where their kids can find out where they can get to school. 315,000 Syrian kids in Lebanon without schooling.
Wow.
It's not just an information source, though. In the modern world, consumers should be able to rate the services they get. This new platform we're developing will allow refugees to say, this supermarket treated me well, this hospital treated me well. That kind of feedback is, I think, going to help improve the quality of services as well as broadcast what services are available.
I wonder if you, or I guess how much you appreciate the irony of the fact that you were a very senior British politician. You lived a life in politics. You left politics. And now your job is to help people whose lives are affected by politics.
Well, there are, I feel I'm helping people whose lives are affected by the breakdown of politics.
Right.
Because
right.
what
better,
is a civil war other than the failure of politics? Now I'm out of politics. I'm at the other end of the telescope. What I always say to people is that the humanitarian sector can staunch the dying, but it takes politics to stop the killing. And you need both. And the Syria conflict is the ultimate example of that.
David Miliband is the president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Chipotle, the fast casual burrito place, says that as of today, its menu is entirely free of genetically modified organisms. The company says the quest to go GMO-free took 2 full years and was not easy. To get enough GMO-free cooking oil, for instance, sunflower seed oil in particular, Chipotle recruited a farmer up in North Dakota to plant acres and acres and acres of GMO-free sunflowers. However, Chipotle's GMO footprint has not quite been zeroed out. A lot of genetically modified crops end up as food for animals, including the cows and the chickens and the pigs that end up in the aforementioned burritos. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
There just aren't a lot of farm animals on a GMO-free diet. They eat mostly corn and soybeans, and more than 90% of those crops come from genetically modified seeds. Rounding up a supply of animals raised without GMO feed would be a big trick. Chris Arnold is a spokesman for Chipotle.
It would be very, very difficult to do short of doing organic meat. And if we wanted to make that switch, you've got another tremendous price premium and an enormous supply constraint.
Chipotle already has problems with supply. The chain maintains humane treatment standards for the animals that end up in its burrito bowls, but it can't always get enough. Right now, that means no carnitas at some Chipotles. Organic meat would be a much tougher problem. Catherine Green is an economist with United States Department of Agriculture.
The supply of beef is extremely limited.
As in, last time USDA ran the numbers in 2011, it was 0.3%. And even when demand goes up, even when prices go up, that doesn't mean supply will follow quickly. Farmers have to use organic practices for 3 years before they can sell the product as organic.
And that's a pretty substantial amount of time for someone to be using organic production methods without being able to tap into the organic price premiums.
That's a big disincentive. And when farmers do switch, there's a long lag. The 3-year transition period and then the 2 years or more it takes to actually raise a cow for slaughter. Meanwhile, the corn chips and tortillas at Chipotle are reliably GMO-free. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
School's out terminally, in fact, for the for-profit educator Corinthian Colleges Incorporated. Classes have been canceled, campuses closed, and 16,000 students displaced after Corinthian ran afoul of government regulators. Marketplace's Tim Fitzsimmons has that story.
The government started poking around because of Corinthian's high prices and dismal student loan default rate. More simply, Corinthian was charging a lot for degrees that were worth nearly nothing, and they marketed them to the poorest students, those most likely to qualify for federal aid. Christine Lindstrom with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group says that was intentional.
Colleges like Corinthian have been violating the spirit of federal aid program now for at least a decade, if not more.
Lindstrom says Corinthian got about $1.4 billion in federal money from its students each year. The beginning of the end came when the government started to restrict the company's access to federal student aid last summer. The government also says it uncovered a scheme by Corinthian to pump up its hiring statistics. And as for the whole for-profit industry, they're staring down something called the Gainful Employment Regulation.
Colleges have, in anticipation of it going into effect, already made changes to end some of their worst performing programs.
That rule says that a for-profit college will risk its access to federal student money if its graduates' debt payments exceed certain percentages of their income. And even though it's been challenged in court by the lobbying group that represents for-profit colleges, it'll probably go into effect this July. Here's Goldie Blumenstick, senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education.
Under that regulation, schools that operate programs that are pretty expensive and where students end up with a lot of debt and low incomes afterwards, those programs would be sort of facing a lot more pressure to shut down.
To put it another way, if a for-profit college like Corinthian is going to get a student into debt, there's got to be a good salary that comes with it later. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I think I made something like $4.65 an hour. It was a lot more than any of my other friends were making.
First jobs, straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 0.2% today, 42 points closed at 18,037. The NASDAQ back down 0.6%, 31 points finished at 5060, that's 5060. The S&P 500 gave away 0.4%, that is 8 points closed at 2108. Things might well have been worse had it not been for Apple. Shares zipped up 1.75% in the regular session, and then came the quarterly report. Earnings per share, revenues, and iPhone sales blew past expectations. Apple, by the way, now has more money than ever to count, a record $194 billion in cash in the bank. As we told you earlier, school's out for good at Corinthian Colleges. 15 years ago, shares in that company were trading at around $60 a whack. Today, well, zero, nothing. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Conference Board issues its Consumer Confidence Index for April. The Federal Reserve convenes a two-day meeting on interest rates, one of eight regularly scheduled meetings of the year. And don't tweet about this as you're driving. Ford, SiriusXM, and Twitter release quarterly earnings. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every now and then, or maybe actually more often than that, there are things that happen in business and the economy that just don't make much sense. Which is why we decided to do a whole series where we take your questions about those things that don't make much sense, and we answer them. It's called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder.
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer. By brain work and blade work.
Today's question comes from listener Lamont Freerks, who wants to know why airlines sometimes overbook their planes, which makes them bump other passengers, which doesn't, on the face of it, make a whole lot of sense. The answer comes from Marketplace's Sabri Benishore.
It is 5:30 a.m.
United Airlines, flight 3454.
We are at Newark Airport.
We are now boarding Group 3 to Economy Lane.
No, no, we are not boarding. Not all of us.
The flight is overbooked, so we're just sitting here waiting. The flight is leaving in 15 minutes, and we're just stuck here.
Danielle Sharp is on her way to Oklahoma, but her flight and my flight were oversold. There were X number of seats on the plane, and the airline sold more than that. The airline asked if anyone wanted to give up their seat, but nobody did. So here we are on the ground.
So it's really stressful and aggravating.
What time did you get here?
I got here at 3 a.m.,
and when this happened, people were asking, why would an airline do this? How hard is it to count the number of seats you have and not sell more than that?
I have no idea, but it's obviously they care more about their money than about us, because they wouldn't inconvenience us like this. So it's about a buck.
Yes and no.
Contrary to what's sometimes popular perception, airlines are not evil.
Samuel Engel leads the aviation practice at consulting firm ICF International. It's not an accident that airlines overbook their flights, and it boils down to one simple reason.
Some passengers don't show up.
apparently passengers are pretty reliably not going to all show up.
So if you know that's going to be the case, you're setting yourself up for flying with empty seats and wasting them.
And to be honest, this seems so fishy to me. If people don't show up, aren't the airlines then just selling the same seat twice and making gobs of money off the poor jerks who are left behind when people do actually all show up?
The airline still gets money for them, right? They just could get more money, right?
Yes and no. They don't get revenue for a seat that goes empty. Whether or not they've sold it, they don't get revenue for a seat that goes empty.
They don't?
Like any other basic accounting, you only get paid when you sell the product.
But if someone buys their ticket and then doesn't show up, isn't that just too bad for them? They've already paid their ticket price?
Put them on another flight.
Well, they don't have to pay for another flight?
Some of them will just not show up because they didn't want to take that trip. But in more cases than not, they arrived at the airport 15 minutes late because there was traffic on the Van Wyck, and they missed their flight, and the airline is going to reaccommodate them on another flight.
So, if airlines didn't overbook, they would lose money. And so, they actually put a lot of effort and money into guessing exactly how many people won't show up.
Virtually all airlines nowadays have fairly sophisticated revenue management systems.
This is Peter Belobaba. He is a research scientist at the International Center for Air Transportation at MIT. And revenue management system just means really complicated computer models that adjust themselves constantly.
Those systems have large databases, historical databases of no-show rates on previous departures of the same flight at the same time of day and in the same market. So these historical databases are then used to build forecasts.
And they work pretty well. Last year, 0.1% of passengers were involuntarily denied boarding. And United, whose flight we were bumped off of, said a lot of that was due to grounded planes, not overbooking. So Engel from ICF International says that in the end, all of this overbooking is actually a good thing because, he argues, it keeps ticket prices down.
The nice way to look at all of this is that the more effectively airlines can fill their seats and generate revenue with the available capacity that they have, the better it is for all of us.
Well, not all of us.
We will be boarding by boarding room.
I'm tired. I want to take a nap. And we're stuck here.
But there's a happy ending to this story, even for Danielle Sharp. Government mandates cash payouts to people who are involuntarily bumped off a flight. And Danielle Sharp got $1,100.
Thank you, Lord. That is a blessing.
At Newark International Airport, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
You all know the standard public radio book interview, right? 4 minutes, maybe, of me or your other favorite host, whoever that might be, chatting with an author about this, that, or the other thing. Well, we got a book in the other day that we decided to do a little bit differently. It's by Merritt Watts, and it's called First Jobs, True Tales of Bad Bosses, Quirky Coworkers, Big Breaks, and Small Paychecks. And we figured that instead of me just asking Merritt a bunch of questions, we would hear from the people whose jobs are in the book. We're going to run a bunch of their stories the next couple of weeks, starting close to home for Merritt with her mom and her first job.
My name is Rita Carbonari, and my first job was packing bacon in a factory. It was my first summer after college. I think it was 74 or 75. My friends and I would go to the beach every day, and about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'd go home and take off my bathing suit, put on a big heavy sweatshirt, warm pants, and I'd spend the rest of the evening in a refrigerated baking packing factory. I had a job as a weigher on the line. A big chunk of bacon would get caught in this slicer. It was sort of a big machete-type blade in a case. I was poking my finger in there, trying to get that bacon out of the way, and one of the supervisors came up and asked what I was doing. He said, "Oh, well, this is what happened when I did that." And he held up his hand, and he only had 3 fingers. I never did it again. I think I made something like $4.65 an hour. It was a lot more than any of my other friends were making. I was happy with the salary. The people that I worked with were very nice, the people that were the regular full-time employees. But I think that they were, I wouldn't say defensive, but they were really encouraging us to continue our education and not to have to do the kind of work that they did all day, every day.
Today, Rita Carbonari works in a college development office here in California. Bacon is still somehow one of her favorite foods. I think she's still got all 10 of her fingers. More stories the next couple of weeks of First Jobs. This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace Protocol desk. The guy who runs the world's third biggest economy, that would be Prime Minister Shinzo Abe of Japan, is in Washington today for talks with the president and a speech to Congress later this week. There is a state dinner tomorrow night at which the White House will unveil the new state China service. That's China small C as in fancy dishes. The description from the actual government protocol office goes like this. The key motif is a fluted band of Kailua blue framed by a textured gold rim and a simple gold inner line that appears on all pieces. The White House Historical Association picked up the tab, total price not disclosed, but the Bush administration's state China cost $493,000. All right, we are out of here. The Dow off 0.2% today, 42 points. The NASDAQ down 0.6%, 31 points. The S&P 500 gave away 0.4%. That is 8 points. The daily production team around here is Bridget Bonner, Gina Delvac, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.